So, podcast listeners out there, think about this situation. You have a situation where you're a parent and you have children, and you go to the doctor, and the doctor tells you that one of your children is suffering from a life-threatening illness. Like, I don't know, I'm not a physician, so something like cancer or something along those lines. The grief and the pain and the worry and the everything would be overwhelming, I imagine. And these things happen occasionally, and the stories aren't told very often, in my experience. Perhaps because Americans like to think about only positive things, but people suffer in this way, and they suffer additionally because there aren't stories out there to help people cope, and there's not a lot of resources out there. Well, one person, a student at Antioch University, Seattle, actually wrote a book to address that. Her name is Kathy Opie, and she has come on the podcast to talk about her new book called A Little Red Wagon Full of Hope. And I have been speaking with her off and on over the last couple years as she's been getting this book ready for publication. And it's finally published and it's out there ready to be purchased online. And so I thought I'd have her on the podcast to talk about what inspired her to write this book and what her experience was in writing this book. Because it's a highly personal book too. It's not just, she's not just right. It's not an academic only book. It's also highly personal. So welcome to the podcast, Kathy.
Thank you. Thank you, Kirk, for having me here tonight.
So just to introduce the podcast, this is the podcast called Psychology in Seattle, and I'm your host, Dr. Kirk Honda, and I am chair of the Couple and Family Therapy Program at Antioch University, Seattle, and I'm also a licensed therapist. And Kathy is a student who will be a licensed therapist soon, hopefully in the next year or two. So Kathy, what inspired you to write this book?
Well, I started telling my story on Caring Bridge as people wanted to know what was going on with our son.
Caring Bridge is a website?
Yes, a website. The blog where you can just post stories or anecdotes about what's going on, what happened at the doctor's office, how you're feeling. Because it was very difficult to tell multiple people every day what was going on with your child or what you needed. And from those Caring Bridge site and posts, people really began to follow them and were interested and said, wow, these are inspiring. We're learning a lot about you and you're a good writer. And they were also quite therapeutic for me. And I found them a way to, share with many people, what we were experiencing. I joined a writing class after my son, about a year after my son was finished with treatment, and wanted to make it into a memoir. But my teacher advised me that I think she said that you had more of a caregiving book that you could help people with. Take some of the stories from your memoir and weave them into something that you could deliver to people, something that could help them with this journey. More of a takeaway for those who are going through a similar situation.
So you were experiencing a child of your own that was suffering. Would you like to talk about that?
Yes. Our son, Connor, was 13 when he was diagnosed with a rare form of bone cancer called Ewing sarcoma. And it presented itself as just what he described as arm pain, random arm pain. And our son was quite an active 13-year-old. He was in soccer, football, he ran cross country. So it just seemed like he was just having regular aches and pains. And he even told us, I just bumped myself, or it's just a soreness. And when we took him to the clinic, the doctors would say, oh, he has growing pains, or maybe he's just not feeling well. Right. And it occurred over several months and was very frustrating.
So he's 13, he's an active kid, he's in sports, he probably has pains all the time in various places of his body. I mean, I was a 13-year-old athlete, and I was, if something wasn't hurting, it meant something was wrong in my life. And so I'm sure that was the initial thought, but then you became more concerned because it lasted for a long time.
Well, and the problem is he began to feel like he didn't want to go anywhere with us. We'd want to take the family out to the movies or go to dinner or join other people to do things. And he just said, no, I'd rather stay home. And he just started just not looking right. He started to almost look gray. And I started just continuing to bother the doctors and saying something is not right. And I called my dad, who was a physician, and he said, you need to champion this cause and do something and call Children's. So I called Children's, not knowing what to do, not knowing what he had, and saying, something's wrong with his arm. I called the orthopedics department. And when I called them, I told them what was going on with him and how he'd been in pain for several months. And then he started mentioning, oh yeah, I've been fainting in the shower and having blackouts. And I was amazed because he'd never told me that before. It was only until we started getting more serious and talking to Seattle Children's.
Do you think that your initial doctors were, initial physicians, were irresponsible? Were they not responding quickly enough?
Well, there's an expression I've heard saying it's hard to look for a zebra in a herd of horses. And if it's something is that rare, they're just not trained to see it. And unfortunately, a bone tumor does not show up in a regular x-ray.
Interesting.
And so you have to order a contrast MRI, and that's only found at a large facility like Seattle Children's.
Interesting. And they did x-ray his arm.
Yeah, at the clinic, and nothing showed up.
Right.
But he was in extreme pain, and he threw up during the x-ray while they were manipulating his arm.
Wow.
You know, in hindsight, there was a huge tumor inside of his armpit that they were moving around thinking that he, because he kept referring to the pain in his arm.
Wow.
And the doctor said, well, he has a stomach ache. And I said, stomach ache? And I said, that's it. We're leaving. We're going to Children's. I'm done here. I was that angry, and I stormed out of the office.
Yeah.
It was so frustrating.
Yeah.
And in talking to other parents that went through this, some of them had similar experiences.
Interesting. Is it just that the physicians and the medical professionals want to make you be quiet? Or, I mean, I'm just trying to understand why they would treat you that way.
Sometimes I think there might be just a feeling of you're overreacting, or, you know, it's a scary situation.
So they're used to, quote unquote, overreacting parents, demanding parents.
Perhaps, yeah. When you're in the medical environment, you really do have to be your own advocate and or your child's own advocate. I've learned that.
The other question that I have is, what was it like when you heard your son say that he was fainting in the shower and having these other issues, and he had never told you before?
It was devastating, and I was shocked. But I think there's, unfortunately, in our society, there's this tendency for boys to have to buck it up, you know, tough it out, just be tough and strong. And even when we were at Children's and the doctors were going over what his diagnosing him and asking questions, he was minimizing it. I just have a contusion. My mom's overreacting. I'm fine. There's nothing wrong with me. Even after he had told me some of the things that he had shared, just this tendency to minimize his pain and make everything better.
And you think that our society socialized him to be that way?
I do. I think there's this tendency to just try to remain strong and stoic.
Yeah. Yeah, I could see that. I mean, it makes total sense to me. It's tragic, though. You just wonder how many young men are suffering from something, anything, even emotional or medical or whatever, and can't reach out because we've told them that they shouldn't.
And unfortunately, if the cancer metastasizes, there's only a 5% survival rate.
Yeah.
If it doesn't, this type of cancer, it's 80% survival rate.
Right.
So the longer you wait, the more dangerous it becomes.
Yeah, I have a similar story. It's not nearly as bad as what you went through. But for me, I played football, and I was constantly injuring my ring fingers. They were always getting caught in between the helmets or jammed on the ball or jammed in someone's uniform or something. And they were, so my two ring fingers, for whatever reason, stuck out like sore thumbs all the time, so to speak. And they were constantly being iced. And, you know, if it was one finger, it would be the next one. And then I really injured my left ring finger, but it was just a series of injuries to those fingers. And then a week went by and it still hurt, and another week went by and it still hurt, and another week went by. And then like 2-3 months later, I said, I think something's really wrong with my hand. And we went into the doctor, and they said that my tendon, that the tendon that pulls the final knuckle, you know, your muscles for your fingers are in your forearm.
Yeah.
And they pull these tendon, these long, you know, tubes, essentially, right. These long, like rubber bandy things, and it pulls on your knuckle. And what had happened is that thing had become detached from the knuckle.
Oh, and what happens is painful.
It was very painful. And what happens is over time, the muscle in the forearm begins to retract because it's not being used. It thinks that it's dying, essentially.
Oh my goodness.
And so it pulls the tendon all the way back. This story's taking way longer than I than
well, it's
I
intended. Interesting though.
But you know, because I waited so long, they had to, they couldn't stretch it back out. If I had complained right away, they could have, it would have been a simple surgery to reattach it.
Oh.
But as it was, since it had retracted so far, they had to insert a new ligament, or a tendon or whatever you call it, yeah. Tendon, I think, in that spot. And so what they had to do is, what was the first thing they did? They put a plastic thing in there first, and then my body made a cyst around the plastic thing, which creates a sheath. And then later, a second surgery, they took an unused tendon from my forearm.
That's painful and complicated.
That wasn't used from, that, you know, like we evolved to not use it as much. Took that out and put it in the tube, in the hand. And all of that surgery, and I had to walk around with a cast on my arm that made my hand do this, Kathy. You could see what I'm doing.
Oh, my goodness. Backwards C.
Yeah, it's like totally contorted hand.
Ow. How long was that process?
Oh, I don't know, months. And then they glued a hook to my fingernail and then put a rubber band.
Oh, that sounds draconian.
Around the fingernail and attached the other end of the rubber band to my forearm. So I was walking around with this like totally.
And you were in high school?
Yeah.
Oh, how terrible.
And then at the end of the day, I still can only move my finger that far. It's like, you can't see it in podcast land, but...
Definitely.
It's still totally... And I have all these scars and everything.
Oh, my goodness.
All because I was socialized not to say anything, mm-hmm. and I waited too long to get it looked at.
Yep.
So that was a long... what do they call that? A long climb for a short fall in terms of that story. But anyway... So Kathy, you go through this experience, and I'm sure the listeners are out there wondering if your son is okay.
Yes, he is. He's 6 years, and they don't use the word cancer-free anymore. It's called no evidence of disease, NED, because unfortunately, or however you want to look at it, the cancer can come back, or it's a walk of faith, a leap of faith. It's just how we perceive and it's our new normal, our reality. And so when you get your scans or you go in every year, that's, you call it no evidence of disease.
Well, that's fantastic. I'm sure everyone's really happy to hear that.
Yeah, he's a junior at WSU.
WSU.
Yes, go Cougs.
Well, no, my rival. I'm a Husky.
I am too, but you know,
proud
family.
proud Husky mother of a Cougar. Do they have that bumper sticker?
They do. That divided purple red.
Yeah.
My husband wears the Husky jacket with the Cougar t-shirt and gets teased all the time.
That's funny. Yeah, my family's same. Half of my family went to Wazoo and the other half went to UW. Essentially, the smart people in my family went to UW.
Mean.
Yeah. So let's back up though. Okay, so we've cut to the chase. We've told everyone that your son's doing well.
Spoiler alert. A good one, though.
Yeah. But let's back up. So you get the diagnosis. How did that feel when that happened? I would have been really angry at the previous physicians for blowing me off.
Oh, yeah. All the records get mailed back to the general practitioner, all the results, all the files. So they get it anyways. But I made a special call. Just to call and tell him what the diagnosis was, because I just needed to do that. So,
by the way, I was right. Is that what you said?
I just called and let them know what he had.
What'd they say? I'm sorry for blowing you off?
No, I was just informed. He will be notified. He gets the records mailed directly to him. Thank you. I will tell him it was not well received, but yeah. That's okay.
Okay.
And then I realized it's not going to solve anything to do that, but I just needed to make that one call.
Absolutely. So then what? Then what did you guys do?
Well, it was just a matter of pulling in all your resources. Our friends and neighbors came together and asked us what we needed, and centralized help and care, made a caring care calendar where we organized the meals, pet walks, housework, chores, breaks for us, because our son could not be left alone for more than 30 minutes at a time. You know, a 13, 14-year-old who couldn't be left alone for more than 30 minutes at a time because he had a central line. You got to imagine there's a tubing in his chest that's directly connected to one of the main arteries in his heart. And so he could not be left alone for more than 30 minutes at a time. And he's immune compromised. So if you needed to do any kind of errand while you're at home or anything, someone needed to be there, you know, within the 30-minute span in case he fainted or had any kind of issue.
Interesting. So he is at home. Mm-hmm. Is he going to school?
No, they pulled them from school because of the immune compromised nature of his illness. And he's tutored at Children's, and also we have tutors come in from the district because of something called chemo brain, where your brain is pretty washed with chemicals and you can't see straight and think straight. It's real hard to study, at least for my son. He had a hard time.
Yeah, and I would imagine it'd be hard to motivate given the stress you're going through.
Yeah, but we tried as hard as we could to maintain as much routine and normalcy as we could. Yeah. Just found that that was really helpful for everyone.
So he's at home and he has this tube going directly into his main artery and it's pumping chemo.
There's a schedule every other, like every 2 weeks, he receives chemotherapy inpatient at Seattle Children's. Uh-huh. And then we're home for about a week or so.
Getting like a low dose chemo?
No chemo. He's resting. But every day we have to flush that central line with saline solution to keep that central line open and clear, or it'll clog up.
And that line is only there because every 2 weeks you go in and...
Yeah. And also... once a week, we go in for blood draws, and they'll take the blood out of the central line instead of poking him with a needle. And there's also new Lasta shots that help boost his immune, I think it's white blood cell. Don't quote me on that. It's been a while. But
yeah.
So anyways, just a lot of care through the home. And then probably about 2 months into his treatment, he had to be given a nasogastric feeding tube. Oh. Which is just a tube that's inserted through the nostril, down the throat and into the stomach that drips nutrient-rich, protein-rich formula.
How come?
Because he lost 20 pounds within 2 weeks, and there was just too much weight loss.
What was it like for him to have a tube in his face?
He did not like that at all.
God, because you would feel it in your throat.
You have to build calluses in your throat, you know, to get used to that, the rubbing. So the first 2 weeks were very, very unpleasant.
God.
And then if you come home after chemo and you're not feeling well and you throw up, guess what comes up? The tube. So there were times where we had to go back to the hospital and get it reinserted.
Wow.
Some kids got good at putting their own tube back in.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Putting it in themselves? How in the world?
Some people just, you know, learned how to just thread it in and swallow it down.
I'll swallow it down.
Yeah, I mean, it's a whole nother world. And then we have it sounds terrible, but there was a time where we have pugs, and one of them got kind of caught up in his tube and pulled it out.
Uh-huh. Oh.
So it was like, instead of the dog ate my homework, the dog pulled my tube out.
Oh.
Doctor.
God.
So that was sort of one of those things you laugh at looking back, but at the time, it's not funny at all.
Not funny at all, yeah.
But
so, a lot of your book is about what you were talking about earlier in terms of getting support and the kinds of routines and the kinds of, it takes a village.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Talk more about that.
Well, I think a lot of people wanted to know what they could do to help, how they could be useful. And some people were really good at, you know, talking and being supportive, giving hugs, coming by, listening. And other people wanted to do more tangible things. They wanted to just be there to help out with everyday chores and work. Some people did grocery runs. Some people came in and mopped the floor, cleaned the bathroom. The problem is, after a while, it just got sort of disorganized. You didn't know when people were coming. So that's where the care calendar was really helpful, because you could post things that you needed done. So yard work or walking the dogs when we weren't at home.
Yeah.
Or
this an online thing? Or?
Yeah.
So
post it online. People could come in and sign up for meals, which was really helpful.
Great.
And then when we came home from the hospital, the house needed to be disinfected. I mean, all the counters wiped down, all the bathrooms wiped down, the floors clean. And so my parents helped with having a maid service come in and clean and disinfect the house, which was huge.
Huh. So if you are suffering in this way, a family suffering in this way, then you're recommending that they do this service online or figure out some way.
Yeah. And usually it takes, usually if you have a friend who's really good at organizing a group of people, it's nice to have one person be the conduit that everybody could come to and just disseminate the information, because oftentimes the family is just overwhelmed,
right,
or completely at a loss sometimes to handle all the requests and information. So it's just really nice to have that person come alongside and take over that job.
Right. And if you have a friend in a family that's going through this, the recommendation is to not just say, I'm sorry that this is happening to you, or let me know if you need anything, instead of just throwing that out there, actually doing something.
Yes. Yes. And being real specific with what they need.
Yeah.
You know, I can do this, or I'm good at doing that. What do you, you know, how can I help? And specifically, what are the things? Because not everybody, you know, wants to sit and hold your hand, but they might be good at yard work, or they might be good with pets, or they might be good with cleaning, or
right,
making a meal.
Right.
Or helping out with the siblings. Sometimes the siblings often get forgotten.
Mm.
Or the partner might need someone to talk to or spend time with, and relationships can suffer. So that's good to remember the whole system, the whole family.
And so in your book, A Little Red Wagon Full of Hope, the full title, Tips and Inspiration from a Loving Caregiver, it talks about that process and really lays it out about how to do all that. Kind of like a guide. So this is kind of, in some ways, not only a book that would help someone going through this to not feel alone, but also to provide tips.
Yeah, exactly. And at the end of each chapter, I have some takeaway tips. Like, for example, one of the chapters is what to say, and then implied is what not to say. When you're with a family who's experiencing something like this, helpful things to say, like, I'm sorry, what can I do to help specifically? And then things that you don't say, are you scared? Boy, I'm glad I'm not you. Those are not things that you might say to somebody, because it just makes them feel bad. If somebody's going through cancer and you start jumping in with, oh, well, in my family, my dad or my mom went through cancer, it minimizes what you're going through, and it doesn't help them on their journey at times.
Yeah.
So just some tips.
Yeah.
And then I also share stories where I had put my foot in my mouth. So it's not just, you know, me saying, do this, do that, but also times when I experienced helpful things that people said to me, and also times when I said some things that weren't helpful unknowingly.
Like what?
I had a friend, my friend Becky, lost all her hair, and she was just really struggling with that. And so I sort of, you know, unknowingly said, oh, it'll grow back. It's fine. We put a hat. They're great. Hats are wonderful. A fun hat. She said, I didn't need to hear that. I'm going to miss my hair. And I was just devastated. I'm like, I am so sorry. I just feel so bad. And she laughed and said, it's okay. And I accept your apology. But I didn't understand where she was coming from. And I needed to really stop and think about how that would feel coming, you know, if I were her, in her shoes.
Yeah. My general, cause I'm writing a book on grief and loss and grief treatment, and all this kind of stuff. And so it's you hear things like this with grief as well. And it's also grief and loss when you lose your hair, or when you lose your health, or, the thing that I say along these lines is similar to that, which is that, try to imagine what it would be like to be that person and to say that. And also avoid just reassuring people that everything's going to be okay.
Yeah.
Avoid trying to look on the bright side. It's a common, you know, human reaction in the face of seeing someone hurt, is to be like, oh, it'll be okay. And to say, you know, how things will improve in the future. You know, you're trying to cheer the person up. You're
right.
Trying to give that person hope. But when the person has lost their hair,
yeah,
and they're in despair over that,
Exactly.
They don't want to hear that everything's going to be okay and that it's going to grow back and,
yeah.
And that it's no big deal, essentially.
Exactly.
Because that's kind of the message of just like, well, just look on the bright side. You'll be okay. And that, on the other hand, the person going through the difficulty has to understand that other people don't necessarily know what you want to hear.
Exactly.
And that they're trying to help. When they're saying things that you don't like, try to empathize with their efforts. You know, they're trying, and you don't have to jump down their throat. You can just say, I know you're meaning well, but that's kind of not what I want to hear right
exactly.
now.
Yeah. I think people need to also not have to feel like they always have to walk on eggshells around a loved one right. or a friend, that it's okay to do your best and try.
Right.
And that's the point.
Right. Cause I've heard some people in my research regarding what to say after a loved one dies, you know, some people will say, don't say I'm sorry for your loss. I don't want to hear that stupid phrase ever again. And, you know, that's probably particular to that person, you know?
Yes.
And you don't want to, if everyone said, don't ever do blank, there would literally be nothing that would be available
exactly.
to the friends.
And yet people that I've asked about, you know, that have lost a loved one, would say, the silence is deafening. People don't say anything, and that's the most hurtful thing.
Right.
And yet, what you said is, then what do you say?
Right.
There's nothing left to say.
Right, because you've heard of so many things
you're running around.
Say.
So you're right, exactly. Yeah. It's just maybe a few things that are particularly helpful or nice. And it's interesting, speaking of the bald thing, there were so many people that were just wonderful and wanted to shave their head in solidarity for my son, but he was just more of a private person and wanted to just quietly just have his head shaved and put on his beanie and grieve the loss of that hair. Mm. And it was different for him. Mm. And I think sometimes you just have to meet the loved one where they're at because...
I'm curious, did that change over time? I mean, with him as he was going through this? Because I would imagine it would be a little hard to remain that way when there's so much difficulty and need for support from other people.
He was fairly introverted and withdrew within his shell for most of his treatment and even after. Mm. And he's just, you know, over the past few years, he's coming out. But I think that's how he responded to what was going on with him.
Interesting.
And, you know, he mentioned doing meditation and kind of going within. And me, I was much more, hey, let's all gather around. And I had to really be respectful of how he was processing his grief and his pain and what he needed. And just to be aware of what your loved one needs versus what you might need are two different things.
Right. Yeah, what an interesting prospect to go through this when you're 13, because that's a particular year in a person's life in America,
it is.
You know?
Yes.
And, you
it's
know,
a particularly difficult one
yeah,
for some.
Right. It's when, I mean, as a family therapist, I've said this on the podcast before, the biggest age group I get in teenagers when they get referred to me are 13-year-olds.
Oh,
yeah.
That's an interesting fact.
Oh, yeah. They're, you know, 17, a lot less, 16, you know, less, 12, 11, a lot less. It's 13 that for some reason, that's when the S hits the fan, so to speak. And, you know, you have attitude, you don't like your parents anymore, you don't want to be around family, you just want to be around friends, you just want to play your video games, you don't want to have anything to do with any family or, you know, I mean, I'm generalizing, of course.
Yeah, no.
But, you know, it's common to go through that, to have attitude, to be kind of snotty and, you know, a lot of rolling of the eyes and whatevers and to then go through, you know, to have bone cancer.
Well, and add prednisone to that.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. And then you get really snarky,
okay.
unpleasant.
Okay,
so
yeah.
So we had to cut that down.
Okay.
And also just, there were times, though, when he would get extra snarky and I'd have to step in and say, uh-uh, especially if it just started with a nurse would come in and give him something or he wanted something and he'd get kind of rude, I'd nip it in the bud and say, uh-uh. You'd say, please, thank you. I don't care if you're not feeling well, that doesn't give you excuse to be rude. And then he understood me.
Yeah.
It's important to be civil. It is.
Yeah.
And again, just to try to maintain as much normalcy as you can.
Yeah, and your role as a parent doesn't end just because he has a life-threatening illness, I guess, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Even though that sometimes it can be difficult.
Yeah. I can imagine. Has he talked at all about his experience looking back?
Yeah. I mean, he has. He didn't choose to read the book, though. He said, I lived it. I don't want to read about it.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Meaning, like, I don't want to relive it, right?
Perhaps. Now. Yeah.
I imagine one day he'll want to read it.
I think so. Yeah. And he has mentioned that, you know, it's more difficult for the parents than it is for the person, for the patient. He said that.
What do you mean? The book?
No, his experience. He thinks it was more difficult for his parents than it was for him.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah.
So his perception is that you guys suffered more than he did.
Yeah.
Huh. Was he ever afraid for his life? Seems like he would have been.
Yeah. He doesn't mention it, but I think, and I speak about one time in the book where he just said, I don't want to do this anymore. It was that we got to be to that point where it was that painful.
Wow. So all the pain and the chemicals and the mm-hmm. nausea
and the surgery.
Oh, he had surgery too on his arm.
Yeah. Though they had to basically cut open his shoulder to remove the tumor and take out part of his scapula and then put in a donor bone and attach it and add hardware in there and reform a new scapula and part of his glenoid or armpit joint.
Whoa.
Yeah. So he's got what he calls a giant shark bite, like a 9-inch scar and a 7-inch scar, one on the back and one on the front.
Huh. So he has metal and donor bone.
Yes.
Like from a donor body.
Yes.
Like someone died and you had a...
Someone about his age.
Interesting.
Yeah. That's a lot to wrap your brain around too.
Yeah. Wow. Did you have to wait for a donor bone to arrive, or was one ready to go?
Well, as soon as he was diagnosed, they put in, they usually apply to the bone bank for donor tissue and bone.
Huh. And then you just, you didn't hear much detail about, do you know who the bone?
No, they don't often tell you who the donor is.
Yeah.
But it is a beautiful gift.
Yeah.
And
it's pretty wild. Does he ever talk about that, having someone else's donor bone in his arm?
I know sometimes when I've brought it up, he says, Mom, don't go there. You know?
Interesting. So he's very introverted.
Yeah, he can be. Yeah.
Or I wonder if he talks with his friends about it.
Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question.
Yeah.
I'm sure as he gets older, more comes out.
Yeah.
And he's interested in doing more of the... I'm involved with the Northwest Sarcoma Foundation, and he's more interested in doing some of the events now than he was in the past.
Oh, tell us about that.
I'm on the board of directors for the Northwest Sarcoma Foundation, which raises research dollars and also gives patient grants for those families that need help with medical bills and financial aid. We do several fundraisers each year, and also just to promote education and awareness about sarcoma cancer.
Have you talked about your book at one of the events?
Yeah, actually, the part of the profits are going to the Northwest Sarcoma Foundation and also to Momcology, which is a national mom support group.
Momcology.
Momcology, yeah. It is a national mom support group for mothers who have children that have been diagnosed with cancer. They provide also retreats around the country in every state. Moms can go on a one-time retreat, all expense paid, to a really nice resort. Huh. You can get pampered for the weekend. Self-care times 10. And I went last spring and it was absolutely fabulous.
Where'd you go?
We went to Leavenworth and had a weekend of just pampering and massages and henna and yoga and good food and...
Beer?
We had wine. It's very nice. Oh, it was Leavenworth.
Yeah. For those outside of Washington State, Leavenworth is like a little Bavarian Disneyland with lots of Oompa Loompa music and beer
and lots of wine shops.
And wine shops.
Yes.
And it's up in
the
mountains.
It's a world attraction. Their Oktoberfest is people come from all over the world.
It's true.
Yep.
I'm assuming that people can buy A Little Red Wagon Full of Hope on Amazon.
Yes. In ebook and paperback.
Do you have a website?
Yes.
What's that?
www.kathyscanlonopie.com.
Kathy Scanlon Opie. Kathy's. And what else do you have on the website?
Well, I post self-care tips, also some recipes and stories that I've written and have published.
So while you were going through this difficult experience with your son, you started to blog and comment on what website?
Caring Bridge.
Caring Bridge. So was there a time when you were in despair and hopeless around your son's cancer?
I think it's just really hard to watch, you know, your loved one, your child suffer, and you just feel powerless to change and help.
Yeah.
You know, normally, I mean, as a parent, we're just, you know, it's innate for us to provide comfort, to alleviate suffering, to be there for our child, to protect them.
Yeah.
And when you have something that's beyond your control, like cancer or another illness, and it's beyond anything that you can even comprehend day in and day out, and you're taken to the hospital and they're administering these medications that supposedly you're curing your child, but they're so toxic that they literally bring your child to the point of near death to cure them. Mm. It's just very, very painful to watch and to experience that. And you're doing procedures and things are being done to your child on a daily basis that are just things most people shouldn't have to do. Mm. And it takes its toll.
What would have helped? I don't know if you went to therapy during this time. Did you go to therapy during this time?
I visited the hospital social worker and reached out to other parents that were going through what similar experience, children that had cancer, and we formed a support group. It wasn't until after we talked about post-traumatic stress that I realized in retrospect that I was really suffering, where it was just hard to, you know, as they say, snap out of it and feel happy, you know, when you, you're done and everyone's, hey, you're done, you should feel happy and you should be, you know, going back to your life now. I felt sad and I felt confused. I thought, why am I feeling sad and angry? I should be happy and thrilled that my child is cured and we're done with this terrible thing and we survived. And it was a very difficult time for me because no one really prepares you for that. And in the hospital, the medical model is, hey, we're done. We've treated you. There's your papers. You can leave now. You're all done. Right. And you've had this very regimented, rigid lifestyle for almost a year and now nothing. And your old life is not going to fit the way it did prior. That's when you have the luxury, so to speak, to be able to feel your feelings and realize this really sucked and it wasn't fair. And now I'm angry and I'm upset. And so, yeah, that's the time when then I did seek some help.
Uh-huh. You saw a therapist at that point.
Yeah, about a year after. Yeah, because it took time to recognize I don't like how I'm feeling.
Yeah. What helped regarding therapy during that time? Like, if therapists are listening out there, what tips do you have for them?
I just think helping to normalize the situation, that when someone has gone through something like this, that it's okay to have those feelings. Mm. It may not take them away, but just to help them realize that it's okay to feel that way.
Mm-hmm.
It's okay.
Okay.
To give yourself permission to be tired, to be sad, to not take on as many of the responsibilities and duties that you may have done before, and that your life may take on a new look, a new normal, so to speak, and be kind and gentle to yourself.
Because you had a tendency not to do that, and a lot of parents don't have a tendency to take care of themselves?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And also, you're dealing with the ramifications of ignoring your marriage or your partnership. And if you have other children, you haven't really attended to them. So you've got a lot of other relationships that are suffering too, compounding, you know. So say you're depressed and not working at your full capacity, and then you also have these other relationships that need you as well. It makes it very difficult.
Yeah.
So the therapist may need to step in, you know, come alongside and maybe help the family as well. And
Yeah. Makes me kind of wonder about your son. I mean, I'm sure you have similar thoughts. It's just like, I wonder if he's okay. Because he went through a lot at an age when you're supposed to be, you know, carefree.
Yeah, he's really come out of his shell.
Yeah.
And I think college has been great for him. He's joined a fraternity and he's made a lot of good friends.
Hmm.
I think over time, as he begins to process his feelings, I think he will deal with it more and more.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he sounds like he's doing great. You know, I had a teenager once, client that had a similar kind of issue when he was really young, like 6 or 7 or something. And there was a lot of residue from that experience, you know, just that all the doctors and the tubes and the fear and the And
well, yeah, and I just remember, you know, just for example, he had his braces on when he was diagnosed, and you can't have your braces on when you're diagnosed. Sorry, back up. when you're going through chemotherapy, you can't have braces.
Okay.
Because of the mouth sores and all the treatment.
Oh.
So when he was diagnosed, he had braces. So they had to remove them.
Yeah.
And that's no fun to have your braces taken off in the middle of all this.
Yeah.
Within a week, he had to have his braces taken off. So the orthodontist pulled his braces off and he said, "Do you mind if we give him his little celebration package? I really want to give him some balloons and some candies, please. Can I just give it to him?" And we brought them home, and his older brother, who was about 15 at the time, came in and just was livid and said, "Who in the hell has the nerve to give balloons to a kid that just got diagnosed with cancer?" And I had to explain to him, no, the orthodontist just wanted to give him balloons just because he got his braces off. Just calm down, please. "Oh, well, can we just take our BB guns and pop them in the garage?" I said, "Okay." So that's what they did, just to kind of diffuse the tension.
Well, that sounds really nice that his older brother wanted to protect his brother.
Yeah, no, they had fought a lot and were very, very competitive and didn't get along real well. His older brother was more of the tougher, bigger, more of an athlete type. Connor was more, I don't know, thinner, kind of studious type. Yeah. And in through this experience, I remember Patrick saying, "Mom, first of all, I should have gotten it. I'm the older brother.
Oh.
I should have gotten this."
Oh, that's really sad.
"And two, there's two kinds of tough. There's yeah. more than one way to be tough, Mom. And he's tough."
Wow.
And they just really got close through yeah. this experience.
It's really sweet.
Yeah.
You're going to make me cry, Kathy. Yeah, so that makes me think of another thing, of the benefits, so to speak, of going through a difficulty like this.
You have to look at it that way. I think, you know, I just think you just do.
Have you heard from anyone?
Yeah, I have. I had some good reviews, and I'll just keep plugging away at it, trying to get it out there.
Yeah, I mean, as a side note, it's been interesting to watch you deftly maneuver through the book publishing process in terms of, you know, designing the book, getting it done, getting it edited, marketing the book, getting on podcasts to talk about the book.
Thank you.
you know, I was even there when you were discussing the cover photograph, and
yeah, and even the back cover has a story too.
Right, exactly. And so, and you asked me to write a blurb, which I can see there. Which
yeah,
which
there it is.
Yeah.
And I appreciate that yeah. so much.
Yeah, and yeah, so it's been interesting. I haven't published any. I have literally 5 or 6 books that are halfway done. I love writing the first half of a book. It's the second half that's not so fun. That's kind of a chore. And I don't have any time recently to finish them. But one day I will be just like you, Kathy, and I'll come on your podcast and talk about my book. Well, thanks for coming on the podcast, Kathy.
Thank you for having me. It's
and
been great.
Congratulations on finishing the book.
Thank you.
I know how much. I wasn't there while you were writing it. I was only there at the end.
It's a labor of love.
Yeah.
Definitely.
I know how hard you've worked on it and how much good it is. You know, there's people that write, you know, say a fiction novel or something, and that's great, but you're actually writing a book that will transform people's lives potentially and will be a, you know, a beam of hope to people out there. I think that's quite,
I hope so.
Quite noble of you.
Oh, that's very kind. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for coming on the show. Well, that does it for another episode of Psychology in Seattle. Thanks for joining us out there, and please take care of yourself because you deserve it.